Hey, you're listening to the wrong podcast. Topics today include lies, letters, and linguine.
Wrong! What's wrong with you? What's wrong with y'all?
What's wrong with you?
What's wrong with you people? Wrong!
You do have to tolerate it. It's my show.
Hi, I'm Tim. I'm here to talk about politics, culture, religion, sports, and anything else you're not allowed to talk about in polite company. Issue number one! Feed up! A couple weeks ago, my family, we went to the Claim Jumper. I don't know if you've got Claim Jumper where you are, but we've got it here. And we got the bill, and I noticed at the bottom, it said 3% fee. I was like, wait, what's this fee for? What's the 3% fee? And the waitress, she, you know, pulled out the menu and pointed out that they have a 3% like inflation fee. And my wife, the lovely Wendy, she pointed out that it was on the door, that it was on a sign on the door. And this is how they're dealing with inflation, which is just not a good idea, it, as far as I'm concerned. It just leaves a bad taste in your mouth. When you think you're going to pay one thing, and then they're like, oh, nope, just kidding, it's actually 3% extra. And, like, I get it, inflation's tough, but this fee doesn't actually fix inflation for them. Like, all their prices still rise, and they're not updating their menus to keep up with that, despite the 3% fee. And they had to reprint their menu to put in this 3% fee. Like, just raise the prices. Like, nobody likes inflation. It's hard and we don't like it, but I just walked away being like, well, I don't really want to eat here anymore because maybe they'll have another fee on me the next time I come that I'm not expecting. It's just a bad idea. I bring this up because I heard about this restaurant. They've got this $50 bad parenting fee, and they insist this is not a fee on children. This is a fee on bad parents who have children. If your kid is being rambunctious and running around the restaurant, they're going to slap a $50 fee on you. And somebody followed up with the restaurant and they're like, hey, look, we've never actually charged anybody the $50 bad parenting fee, but it's there just to offer the threat of it. Meanwhile, their Yelp reviews are full of people who say, yeah, I got charged the $50 fee. I don't know what's going on, but some of you should probably avoid that restaurant. Issue number two, offended. Isn't that cool how I like just offended some of you and your parenting skills? And then I said the next issue is on being offended. Totally unrelated topic. But I'm a fan of strongly worded letters. Big fan of strongly worded letters. I've written a few strongly worded letters myself. And a regent from the University of California, he's like a muckety-muck who's in charge of all of the University of California schools. He wrote a strongly worded letter to a professor at University of California, Merced. And, well, it wasn't just to this one professor. It was to a group of professors. They're the UC Ethnic Studies Faculty Council. And gosh, you know, just hearing that name is enough to keep me out of academia. Like, they've got a faculty council on this thing. And I am sure that this faculty council has no responsibilities whatsoever, but they still felt it important to form the council. So let me back up just a little bit. Hamas attacked Israel. The regents of the University of California felt it was important to write a letter condemning Hamas and their terrorist attacks. And I agree in principle that Hamas and terrorism needs to be condemned. I'm not sure I think that the University of California needs to react to everything in the news. I think it's better when companies and organizations just stay in their lane because, you know, well, let me put it this way. We've all seen this thing on Facebook and Instagram where some tragedy happens in the world and people start putting flags on their profile photos to express their solidarity with that issue. And, you know, sometimes people will actually get silly with it and they'll just keep adding flags. Eventually, their face is just covered with flags with all these things that they care about. And when you say that, you know, when you step out of your lane and you say that you're supporting so-and-so or you're troubled by this or that for a company, when a company does that or an organization does that, well, that raises the question every time some other thing happens, right? Like, well, why don't you have a flag for Nepal? Or why don't you have a flag for Botswana? And you gotta deal with it, right? Like, why do we say something about France but not Botswana? I don't know what happened in Botswana, but I'm sure something bad happened in Botswana. So, and then in addition, progressives, people who are really into woke ideology, they say things like, hey, you can't be silent about this. Silence is violence. Neutrality is complicity. Like, you have to speak up about this thing that I care about. And so, you know, people feel compelled to speak so they're not accused of being culpable with it. And I think the better policy is just stick to your lane. But the University of California wrote this letter condemning Hamas and terrorism, which I agree with. And the ethnic studies faculty wrote back saying they disagreed with the letter. So this regent of the university system, he wrote back. And I'm just going to read this word for word because I like it. There are absolutely no words to describe how appalling and repugnant I found your October 16th, 2023 letter from the UC Ethnic Studies Faculty Council to the regents of the University of California, as well as our chancellors and president. I'm just pausing right here. The UC system is governed by regents, chancellors, and a president. I don't know how any of this is working out, but I'm sure the flowchart is super clear. It probably doesn't require a master's in organizational leadership to understand it at all. Let me continue. Your letter is rife with falsehoods about Israel and seeks to legitimize and defend the horrific savagery of the Hamas massacre of October 7th. Simply put, October 7th was the deadliest single day for Jews since the Holocaust. As you know, on October 9th, the University of California Board of Regents Chair Lieb and UC President Drake issued a statement clearly condemning the acts of terrorism, while also recognizing the impact and suffering this situation will have on civilians in Gaza. You have asked for us, as a body, to retract our, quote-unquote, charges of terrorism, to uplift the Palestinian freedom of struggle, and to stand against Israel's war crimes against the ethnic cleansing and genocide of the Palestinian people. Let me be clear. I will do everything in my power to never let that happen. Full stop. Our statement of condemnation of the October 7th massacre of Israeli civilians by Hamas was absolutely justified and necessary because terrorism has no place in our world. As human beings, we need to condemn it immediately and forcefully without fear of retribution or that some may be offended. The UC Ethnic Studies Faculty Council's opposition to the regents and president's characterization of Hamas's attack as an act of quote-unquote terrorism intentionally ignores the reality of the situation and can be interpreted as a justification of Hamas's shocking brutality, in which babies, children of all ages, the elderly, the disabled, and people from all walks of life were shot, raped, tortured, maimed, mutilated, decapitated, and burned alive. Over 230 more were ripped from their homes and kidnapped to Gaza, where their fate remains unknown. These are the acts behind this current conflict, and they are absolutely, verifiably, and undeniable. To whitewash them is a flagrant and willful abdication of your professional responsibility and indeed morality. It is beyond shocking and almost hard to believe that your entire council would stand by your letter's falsehoods, inaccuracies, and anti-Semitic innuendos. It is even more disturbing that the UC Ethnic Studies Faculty Council and its signatories have demonstrated no empathy for Jewish life, nor seek to use their platform to advocate constructive paths to improve the situation for Israelis and Palestinians. Instead, your council has willingly chosen to be surrogates and supporters for Hamas's destructive actions. The UC Studies faculty letter does not come in a vacuum, but at a time when Jewish students across the country, including all of our UC campuses, are experiencing anti-Semitic threats and intimidation. Your blatant and baseless rhetoric feeds into this hostile environment. Good people everywhere want a better future for Israelis and Palestinians, one that provides security, dignity, and prosperity for both peoples. Such a future will not come from the barbarity of Hamas, whose evil actions are not only discredited against the people of Israel, but against Palestinians, civilians of Gaza, each and every day. Over the course of the last 16 years of ruling Gaza, Hamas has built its military infrastructure underneath schools, hospitals, mosques, and apartment dwellings with callous disregard to civilian life. Equally distressing, the UC Ethnic Studies Faculty Council includes over 300 faculty members across the UC system who could very well be the individuals who are teaching and training, essentially shaping the next generation of students and the next generation of professorate ethnic studies teachers in our state. The thought that young and impressionable students might be taught the falsehoods of your letter absolutely sickens me. The UC was built on the promise that we must all find ways to foster healthy dialogue, empathy, and constructive paths to promote change for the betterment of society. Your letter does none of this. In fact, it does the opposite. It perpetuates hate and discrimination. As unanimously confirmed, twice appointed regent of the University of California, I was tasked with creating a safe environment for all of our students and staff at the UC. So let me be crystal clear with no ifs, ands, or buts. I stand by that commitment and will do everything in my power to protect our Jewish students, and for that matter, everyone in our extended community, from your inflammatory and out-of-touch rhetoric. I strongly urge your organization and your members to issue a public statement retracting the statements in your October 16th letter and clearly condemn Hamas's horrific attack on innocent Israeli civilians, as well as other nationalities, on October 7th as terrorism. Plain and simple. In addition, your organization should commit to learning more about anti-Semitism and all forms of hate and how it lives on our campus, where you are tasked and trusted with educating our next generation of students and leaders. Sincerely, Jay Suris, Regent of the University of California. Hey, it's time. What are the rules?
Oh, what are the rules?
What are the rules?
What are the rules?
What are the rules?
Here's something you need to know about me. I am really good at following the rules. If you tell me that I can get something if I just follow these sets of rules, I will get that thing. I can follow rules like nobody's business. So, recently, I was trying to reserve a room at our city's community center. And I wrote on a Monday asking if I could reserve this room. And the guy in charge of reservations, he said, yes, but you can't reserve it until 45 days before the event that you want to host. And that happened to be 2 days later. So he says, hey, it's a first come, first serve basis. You can't reserve it until Wednesday, though. I said, great. He like sent me the application over email. First come, first serve basis. I can do this on email. I've got the perfect way to do this. I'm going to fill out the application and I'm going to schedule it to send at 12:01 Wednesday morning. Nobody will be first in front of me because I'm sending it at 12:01 Wednesday morning. So Wednesday afternoon comes about and he writes back and says, hey, thanks for your application. Oh, by the way, his PDF form, it was just like something you fill out on paper. Like I changed it for him. I made it fillable and sent him a blank version so that he could send that blank version to other people in the future. So Wednesday afternoon, he emails back, says, hey, thank you so much for that fillable PDF. That was super nice of you. Unfortunately, somebody signed up for the room before you. And I went, how is this possible? I submitted my application at 12:01 on Wednesday. So I call him and say, hey, how is it possible that somebody submitted their application before me? And he said, oh, they came in Tuesday night and we accepted their application Tuesday night. And I was like, but wait, you just told me I had to wait till Wednesday. How? On Monday, you said I couldn't do it on Monday, but on Tuesday, you told somebody else that they could submit their application. I didn't say it like this. I was trying to be nice and get what I wanted. But still, like, you're with me, right? Like, I followed the rules. And then he told somebody else, oh, no, don't worry about the rules. That's cool. And then he comes back to me and says, oh, you didn't get it because, you know, we don't need to follow the rules. I was flabbergasted. And something had to be fixed. So I asked for his supervisor's number and called him. Well, the supervisor, he understood the problem and said, I will for sure talk to him about this. And I told him, hey, we're willing to work with the other people. You know, if they don't need it all day, let's work something out. And he gets back to me right away and goes, actually, there's a total solution to this. You need it in the day. They don't need it till 6 p.m. So you can both have the room. Phew. So here's the rule. Follow the rules. Remember, I want to know what's wrong with you.
What's wrong with you?
If you'd like to submit a question, topic, or tell me how I was wrong, you can email me at listen@thewrongpodcast.com. Or submit a comment at my website, thewrongpodcast.com. And help me spread the wrong message. If you like what you hear, share it with your friends. Now it's time for my favorite part of the show, I Was Wrong.
I was wrong. I was wrong.
Listener Josh writes in and he says, long O in Ozempic. Do your research, Tim. Followed up by listener Matt, who says, Ozempic, like Olympic. And yes, you're both correct. You're both correct. And in fact, listener Josh, here's the deal. I did do my research. I was like, I need to know how to say Ozempic before I do this, because I'm going to look like a fool if I say it wrong and get all kinds of letters from people saying, hey, it's not Ozempic, it's Ozempic. Here's what happened. I researched it. Made sure I knew how to say Ozempic. And then I wrote up the episode and was really, really focused on the Israeli-Palestinian stuff. And what happened in my brain is it forgot how to say Ozempic. And I hit record and I went, oh crud, I forgot how to say Ozempic. But I just kept going with it because I thought it would be entertaining. And I guess it was. So here's how you, dear listener, can remember that it's Ozempic, like Olympic. When you see somebody who's lost a lot of weight, you say, oh, Ozempic. Oh, you lost a lot of weight. I got nothing. Second thing all of you need to know about. This is episode 98. That means that we are only two episodes away from episode 100. Episode 100. I'm going to do something special for episode 100, the lovely Wendy has agreed to let me host a live recording for episode 100. It will be on Sunday, December 3rd at 7 p.m. at my house. Thank you, lovely Wendy, for allowing this to happen in our house. You are all invited. If you can hear my voice and it's before December 3rd, 2023, please come to this live recording. It's going to be fun. And if you would like to come, you just need to email me at listen@therongpodcast.com and I will tell you where to go. But December 3rd, 7 p.m., 100th episode recording, live recording. It will not be on Zoom. It will be in your podcast feed. But if you want to see it live, you've got to come to my house. We will have question and answers. I will let you come onto the podcast and say something ridiculous, to which I will respond with something witty and clever. Issue number 3, privilege. There is a lie that rich people tell poor people that keeps poor people poor. There is a lie that rich people are actively telling poor people, and it keeps the poor people poor. This is the plot of a number of movies. The one that comes to mind is this Matt Damon movie called Elysium, where rich people actually lived off of the planet in this big orbiting ring above Earth, and the poor people were kept down on Earth, and they weren't allowed to go up, you know, into the elite society. Lots of movies like this. This is the theme of just about every conspiracy theory out there, that the elites are in on something and they're not telling everybody else. And if only we all knew about it, if we could get the information out there, they couldn't pull this one over on us. And I don't bring this up just to set up the theme of a movie or to explain conspiracy theories. This is actually happening right now. This has been happening in our country, in our culture, for over 20 to 30 years, and we are seeing the fruits of it. It's actively happening right now. There is a gap between rich people and poor people, and it is widening. And one of the things that's causing it to widen, to make those lines even sharper, is this lie that the rich people tell the poor people. Now, before I get into the lie and what it is, I want to clarify something. Like, I could literally say this thing on every podcast because it's so true, because every time you want to make a point about something, somebody else will say, well, nuh-uh, here's the deal. If I say that 7 out of 10 people who smoke will die prematurely, that means 3 out of 10 people will not die prematurely from smoking cigarettes. I don't know if that, I'm making up that stat. That stat's meaningless. I'm just using it as an example. So if I say 7 out of 10 people who smoke are going to die early, if you come to me and say, well, I know about, you know, my uncle Henry, he smoked all his life and he lived to 100, so clearly you're not right. No! When I say 7 out of 10, that doesn't mean 100% of people. That means 70% of people. That means there's 30% of people that this thing doesn't apply to. They're the exception. So if you bring up one person who had something or did something or didn't do something, that doesn't disprove the stat. They're actually accounted for in the 3 out of 10. Right? You with me? All the time, this comes up, all the time. Like, your one person is not data. It is data. He's part of the data, but he's an anecdote. And there's, you know, millions and millions of other people that kind of drown out that one exception that you happen to know about. Like I said, it's not super relevant. Well, it's relevant to this, but I could go on that rant every single episode, but I won't. Okay. Let me calm down. Calm down from that rant. I don't need to be this angry about this topic, but I wanted to be about that thing. Okay. So as I get into this, I am not talking about individual stories. I'm talking about the whole forest. When we look at the whole forest, not individual trees, there is something that we can see happening. And in particular, one section of the forest is dying. And we might, if you were charged with the health of a forest and you were flying over in a helicopter, you could see that one side of the forest was dying, that it was rotting. You might be interested to go down and see what's happening to that section of the forest. And this all starts with Murphy Brown. About 30 years ago, there was this sitcom called Murphy Brown, and it was about this newswoman, and she was single, unlucky in love, very hard driving woman. And, you know, I remember watching the show. I remember thinking it was funny. She could never keep a secretary because she was such a hard driving person, and she would always get zany people to be her secretary. In fact, at one point, the actor who plays Kramer played Kramer on Murphy Brown and acted as her secretary. And weird crossover because they were on different networks, but they did it. It was funny. He was the perfect person to pretend to be her secretary for one episode. So something that happened with Murphy Brown is that at some point the character decided that she wanted to be pregnant and have a baby. She got pregnant. She wanted to keep the baby. And she did not want the father of this baby in the baby's life at all. She was going to raise this child without its father. And the vice president at the time, Dan Quayle, he was a conservative Christian man. He said, hey, this is not cool. This is not going to go well for society. If we're hoisting Murphy Brown up as this example for people to follow. And people went after Dan Quayle like crazy. Like, they were so on him for saying this. How dare he? How dare he make judgments about this TV character? It's a television show. It's not real life. And even if somebody was making this decision, how dare he moralize about it and feel like that just because he's the vice president, it's his place to say anything about other people's private personal choices. And, you know, since then, we've all heard the cultural arguments. People say, hey, there's lots of different ways to raise children. There's lots of different ways to form a family. Families come in all kinds of shapes and sizes. And, you know, what's really important is that we don't moralize. You don't know the individual circumstances that cause somebody to come to this decision or that decision about how to raise their own children. And you just need to shut up and stay out of it. And undergirding all of that, I believe, is this cultural emphasis on sexual freedom. Sexual freedom is really, really important to our culture. And part of sexual freedom is how you can make sex more free is to separate it from childbearing. We want sex and childbearing to be two different things. The act happens to do these two different things, but we really want the pleasure and fulfillment that comes from the sexual activity to be different from childbearing, even though the same thing produces both. There's this economist I want to tell you about. Her name's Melissa Kearney, and she just came out with this book, and she's out promoting this book, and she's a top-notch economist. And I'm not pointing her out because she happens to agree with me and my worldview. She doesn't come from the Christian world. She's like, you know, an Ivy League educated economist, award-winning kind of economist. And she has been studying what separates children of privilege from children who lack privilege. And what she has concluded is that raising children in a two-parent home is the best way to grant those children privilege and the opportunity for advancement. Raising kids in a two-parent home is the best way to grant them privilege and opportunity for advancement. That's what her data says. She's not coming at this from a particularly religious worldview. She's just presenting the data. Hey, there's a gap between this set of kids and this other set of kids. And there's all kinds of factors that go into this, but the one that's most clear is that the kids who do better are the ones who are raised in a two-parent home. And when I say that rich people tell poor people a lie that keeps them poor, this is exactly what I'm talking about. Because the rich elites, academic, political, cultural, you know, movie makers, songwriters, performers, actors, actresses, they've all been declaring this sexual freedom thing, this freedom from childbearing. And they've been saying, hey, families don't need to look like a two-parent home. They can look any way, and it's all going to work out. They're the ones who are decrying Dan Quayle for decrying Murphy Brown. And here's the thing you need to know about rich elites. Whether they're conservative or progressive or moderate, they love to get married, and they love to stay married. So even though they're saying this one thing out of one side of their mouth, hey, you don't need to get married to raise kids, it's cool, it's fine, it's... they know intuitively that it's probably better off if you do. If you do get married and raise kids in a two-parent home. And you can tell that they believe it because that's what they do. Don't listen to what they're saying with their words. Go look at their actions and you will find that they love marriage. And their kids benefit greatly from it. Women who only have a high school diploma are 3 times more likely to raise children without a father than women who go to college. And when a father isn't present, those women are 5 times more likely to be in poverty. They're 5 times more likely to be in poverty because the father of their children is not around. And Kearney, she looked at this in all kinds of different ways. And she said, hey, it's not just a rich thing and a poor thing. When you look at people who have similar economic statuses, we can just look at the poor people, or we can just look at the middle class people, or we can just look at the rich people. Just make sure that apples are apples in all circumstances. And if you're in a similar economic class as somebody else, and you raise your children without the father around, your children will do more poorly than the kid in the same exact school district, the same exact suburb, the same exact income level, who has both parents around. And Kearney, she is part of policy making decisions. She goes to these boards and you know, different policymakers, and she's looking at all this stuff, and people are trying to come up with ways to help people come out of poverty and make sure those kids have the same advantages and the same privileges as kids who already have those advantages and privileges. And she says, hey, why aren't we talking about marriage? Why aren't we telling people, hey, you should really make sure that your children's father is a part of their life? And without fail, every time she brings this up, everybody's like, oh, you know, well, I mean, that's not really our job to tell people that. Like, we can't really, how are we supposed to tell people that they should make sure, you know, we can't do that. Like, can we just give them some milk money instead? And her point is that it is far more meaningful. The outcomes are far more meaningful to have both parents in the child's life than to give the mother $2,000 a month, no strings attached. Like, just giving people money doesn't solve the problem. It doesn't actually improve the life of the child as much as having both parents in the child's life. And there was one review, they read her book, and basically the review said, yeah, she's got the data, but really, she shouldn't say this kind of stuff. She really shouldn't say this kind of stuff. Like, we can't tell people that they should get married or that both parents should be part of their child's life. We can't say that. One of the really interesting things that she points out is that when people have more money, they have more kids. And, you know, this kind of seems intuitive. Yeah, we've got some extra money. We've got some more we got some more breathing space in our finances. Let's have another kid. And typically, what happens is that those people, they get married. But recently, that's not happening anymore. And she points to this fracking boom in South Dakota. It was a great case example for her because it was blue-collar people who suddenly had more money because of this fracking boom. And these people as expected, had more kids, but suddenly they didn't get married like they used to. There's lots of other, you know, other kind of situations in the recent past where, you know, you could point to where things are very similar to this fracking boom. And in the past, people would have kids and get married, or get married and have kids. But recently, they're just having more kids and they're not getting married. And she didn't really talk about why. And I think this is the thing that she hasn't occurred to her yet. Or if it has occurred to her, she's not saying it. About 15 years ago, our culture decided to change the definition of marriage. We decided that we no longer wanted marriage to be about a conjugal union between two people that had the possibility of producing children. Instead, our definition of marriage was about an emotional definition. It was about personal affection to another person. We went from this one definition where, hey, these people who might produce children out of their relationship, that's what a marriage is, to, hey, these two people love each other a lot. That's our new definition of marriage. And when you change that definition of marriage, it makes sense to me that, yes, people are going to have more kids, but marriage doesn't mean that thing anymore because we've changed that definition. So I'm not at all surprised to hear that people are still having kids but are not getting married. So what do we do about this? How do we fix this issue for kids who are not receiving the benefits that all the rich kids are? And clearly, I don't think moralizing the issue is going to help it. I think people went after Dan Quayle and were saying something true. Hey, you can't moralize this. That's not going to fix the situation. I think there's a lot in wokeism and progressivism that proves this point. Because in my view, the people who are woke are the new moralizers. They're the ones who want to shame people and guilt people into doing what they want. And we don't like it from the right, and we don't like it from the left. But we need to get the word out. Hey, this is the best way to raise kids. Kids benefit the most when both parents are in their lives. We should be encouraging that however we can. And I don't know what kind of political policies are going to make that happen. But for sure, culturally, that's something we need to get the word out about. Hey, you want your kids to benefit? You want them to do well? Make sure both mom and dad are in their lives. And I know you've got a situation where that's not true. I know you've got some individual situation, and I probably agree with you about that individual situation. If the dad's an abuser, things are probably going to go better for mom and the kids if he ends up in jail. I agree. I agree with that individual situation. But when we look at it as the forest, what's going to help the most kids possible? But I could be wrong. If you think I am, let me know. Let me know why. I had fun, and I hope you did too. Bye-bye.